This is George Von Driska, and you're listening to the Builder Sessions.
George, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, guys, for having me. I really appreciate it. We were chatting a little before we started recording here, and I said it takes me by surprise when people ask to hear what I have to say. So I appreciate the ask.
We are all open ears here.
Yeah, we're all learners. Yeah, no kidding. So, George, just for those of us or those of our listeners who aren't familiar with yourself and what you do, share a little bit about yourself.
A weird story, I guess. So you guys are both teachers. I went to college to be a tech ed teacher at a time when tech ed was still called industrial arts. Graduated with my teaching degree at a time when tech ed programs were closing. So it was really hard to find a teaching job. So one thing I did, rumor was there was going to be this great new program called the Technology of Science or the Science of Technology. So it was going to be a mix of like physics and chemistry and tech ed. So would talk in physics about an airplane wing, and then you would all go in the shop and build an airfoil. So I went back to college and I got another degree in physics and chemistry so that I could teach the science aspect and the tech ed aspect. And that program never went anywhere. So I ended up with another degree, but diverging here. So in the end, I got hired at a couple different teaching places. One of the big influence really was when I was hired by ShopSmith back when they still had retail stores. They also had schools in the stores. So I got hired to run a school in St. Paul, Minnesota. And that was really the start of my adult ed program. Eventually the ShopSmith stores closed. But at that point I had developed a bunch of curriculum that I had at my fingertips. So I took that to the woodworking shows, to Rockler, to Woodcraft, basically anybody who would have me, I would offer my services to teach. I was teaching in a Woodcraft store and there was a guy looking through the window into the classroom for a really long time. And it later turned out he was scouting video talent for the North American Outdoor Group, which was Handy magazine. He couldn't find any talent, so he used me instead. And I did
come on.
I did three woodworking videos for them in about 99. And then the company I work with now, TN Marketing, which owns Woodworkers Guild of America, they wanted to do woodworking videos in about 2007, and a guy who worked for them previously had worked for North American Outdoor Group and said, well, in like 99 we used this guy in Wisconsin, maybe he's still available. So they found me and we talked, and so in 2007 the idea was to shoot about 50 woodworking DVDs and then be done. That was going to be the end of it. We did about 125 woodworking DVDs and then turned it all into a streaming platform online. So
cool.
Where it was going to kind of be not one and done, but kind of relatively speaking, one and done with Woodworkers Guild of America. That's still my primary thing today, is I manage all the content on there. We do have other people come in for videos. Char Miller King was just here. Jimmy DiResta was just here. We use outside people for videos whenever we can, but I'm the primary video person. And like I said, I manage all the content that goes on the site. And then outside of that, I teach whenever I can. I teach in my shop here in Western Wisconsin. When stuff is more normal pre-COVID, yeah. I'm typically on the road teaching about once a month.
Oh, cool.
That could be a retail store, a woodworking club, kind of whoever will have me. The Maker Camp up in the Catskills, I'll be there again. That'll be my third time there. So yeah, it's a bunch of different stuff makes up my year. The video shoots, writing. I've got two books I did. Some very cool teaching gigs. I taught for Northwest Airlines before it was Delta, which was very interesting to teach woodworking to an airline company. I taught in the Pentagon in 1 week stints about every 6 weeks for about 2 years. I was teaching woodworking in the Pentagon. Wow. So yeah, just a lot of cool.
Holy
Peace Corps.
Smokes.
I lives in Africa for about 3 years with Peace Corps. So yeah, a lot of weird stuff woven in and out of the big story.
Were you around the trades or building when you were younger? You mentioned you went like kind of your schooling and stuff, but like at a younger age, were you a hands-on person? Did you build lots? Like what about before, like kind of middle school, high school, were you around builders and stuff?
So I would say before we use the word maker in our standard parlance, I guess I was a maker as a kid, you know, like I was putzing with stuff all the time. And I think part of this, so there's two things. I think part of it was whatever's in our genes that makes us want to do that. And I have just a lot of natural curiosity. I wonder if, So part of that as a kid was when we had a lawnmower that we weren't using to mow lawns anymore. And we had a baby buggy, and this isn't like in the, like the baby strollers we think of today. This was a baby buggy that like the wheelbase was 4 feet long and 3 feet wide. It's this like, was a huge thing.
It was a Cadillac.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So I remember building a wooden frame and putting the axles on there and then the lawnmower engine on the back, you know, trying to build a go-kart is what I was doing at, I don't know. I'm not sure I was 10 at the time, 10 or 11. I don't know. And then I think the other function in there is my dad died when I was real young, four sisters. So I think just there was a lot in the household of the girls are washing the dishes. George, can you fix this broken thing? And that was whatever that was. And I would putz with it and see if I could fix it. And later I was in Boy Scouts, very active in Boy Scouts with a great troop. And I think that was also part of it is all that bushcraft, and everything that we did with scouts was a big part of it. But yeah, I was extremely lucky in that, I was already invested or interested in this idea of doing stuff with my hands. I had a shop in my mom's garage before I was even in high school. I had a shop. I'd been given a scroll saw first, and then, I got a lathe, a wood lathe. Which is still one of my favorite tools to work with. Not that lathe, but turning.
Yeah.
And then a Wen router. So those are the first three major power tools I remember. But anyway, I set up in half my mom's garage. I set up a shop when I was in about eighth grade. This was in Chicago. I bought a wood burner so that I could keep the shop warm in the wintertime. So I was out there doing that stuff all the time. And I had a really good middle school tech ed teacher. And I love this guy, Bill Mathis. And I decided when I was in sixth or seventh grade, I want to be a shop teacher, just like Mr. Mathis. And I flat out said to him, how'd you get here? What do I need to do this? And he said, well, I worked in the trades. I went to college at University of Wisconsin Stout. I took every woodworking class I could take. So that was it. That was my template. And I went to the same college he had gone to. That's where I got my tech ed degree from. And I took, just like he said, we had a great shop program in high school that covered all of automotive, drafting, woodworking, building construction, plastics, metals. I took every one of those classes and then went to school to be a tech ed teacher. Yeah. So it's just like, when somebody's like, when my children say to me, I don't know what I want to do when I'm done with college, and they're all past that now, but like, I don't know. I can't relate to that conversation, man. Cause I was like, I had blinders on and I was focused on, I mean, primarily woodworking, but working with my hands since forever. Yeah. And my very first job was pumping gas. But then that was also a spin and a wrench. Like when this was 69 cents a gallon was the price of gas. And when you weren't pumping, filling somebody's tank, because there was no self-serve, you were changing oil on somebody's car. So I was also spinning a wrench at that place. And then my second job was a lumberyard. And I was stacking lumber, but also learning about material and the difference between Doug fir and pine and all that stuff. And then I put myself through college working building construction. So with my tech ed degree, I ended up with a vocational certification to teach building construction because I had enough hours for that. So yeah, it's just been like, I don't know. I've been putzing and highly distracted all my life by just like seeing something that's cool. And I wonder if I can do that. And that's still today. I I recently bought a forge and an anvil see if I can do that. So
that's awesome.
Never stops. Yeah.
So that you mentioned, my next question was going to be, was there anyone specific that inspired you to get, you know, on your journey? And it sounds like that teacher was pretty inspirational in your journey. And is there anyone else that you could name to say like, okay, well, this person was a cool mentor in this area, or whether it's career or a specific skill set? Is there anyone else that really helped inspire you to go?
Yeah, there's a guy that my dad was a chemical engineer at General Mills, died very young, died at 40.
Sorry to hear that.
He had a friend at General Mills, but the friend was in Minneapolis. So another George. My dad was George, and of course I am, and his friend was George. So just to confuse the picture. but George Johnson from Minneapolis, what started as him asking my mom, like, is George in Boy Scouts? What is the troop doing? And my Chicago Boy Scout troop was very inactive. They did not do a lot of stuff. George was a scout master of a Minneapolis troop that was extremely active. So that led to spending pretty much all of my summers from an early age. I spent in Minneapolis, not in Chicago, because I'd come up here to do stuff with George's troop. He was a crazy good carver, whittler. He did some woodworking. He did a lot of home improvement. So, you know, the Boy Scout influence, which came from George having such a crazy active scout troop, plus the things that he did. He tried to teach me to carve, which did not work for these hands. But yeah, he was huge as well in the whole woodworking, doing, fixing side of stuff. He was not one to, he had a Volkswagen Beetle was his car. And, he was not one to call a mechanic on that car. He'd try to fix it himself. And I'd be 10 years old laying in his driveway under the car with him doing whatever he was doing. So, and I'm going to add something to that and say for my, the old guy giving advice is,
oh yeah, bring it on.
When you have that person in your life, you need to, while they're still around, go and tell them what that influence was all about. And I'm very lucky. Bill Mathis died at a very young age of stomach cancer. And I'm so like just dumb luck happy that when I was in Peace Corps in Africa, I wrote him a letter and said, here's what's going on here. And this is like, I was teaching woodworking. This is a crazy cool experience. I love this. This is really neat. And part of the reason I'm here is because of the influence you had on me as a teacher. And by the time I was back from Africa, he had died. So I never had a chance to do that face to face, but I subsequently spoke to his wife and she remembered him getting the letter from me from Africa. So I think it's you know, and I know how it is. I teach a lot. And you throw all of this stuff out there and you're just hoping it's having a positive effect on somebody.
Hoping something sticks.
Yeah. So I think I would say to people, if you've got somebody in your life that had that kind of immense positive influence on you, you will make that person feel incredibly good if you go to them and say, this is the deal. And thank you so much, or whatever you're going to say.
Those influences can be, there's been a lot of parallels with a lot of the guests on the show about starting out in middle school or high school and having an influential tech ed or shop teacher. And when we're teaching, sometimes, like you said, you're throwing all this information out, hoping they're getting it, not sharing how you connect with people. And then lots of times later in life, they kind of come back and then they start to say, hey, you know what? I really enjoyed this. And at the time you're kind of like, oh, are these students or, you know, college students, are they getting this? Are they, and a lot of times, yeah, I guess it's probably good to mention that to people sooner than later. Cause lots of times you're sitting there like, oh, I don't know about this. Or are the students or the kids understanding this or having fun? And, you know, 4 or 5 years down the road, you might hear from some and then, okay. And then you get those kind of stories that really make you feel good that they're like, oh, that kind of helped me through high school or college. And, you know, it was the best class. We had fun and I learned a lot, but you don't get that instant response sometimes. And you're kind of like spinning your wheels of, am I doing this? Am I doing an okay job here?
It's good to know, right?
Yep. Yep.
And not for ego purposes, but like, or sometimes you don't even know that you're making an impact. I remember I used to work at the same school as Corey, and I was teaching automotive and auto body at the time. And we had these two kids. They were kind of rough around the edges, but they were fun. And, you know, this the crowd, I don't know. They're the kids that I connect with the most. And we were having a pancake breakfast we hosted in the shop, and the whole school came through, and we fed them pancakes and stuff. Pardon me. And we saw this, these two kids I'm thinking about, they're sitting with us just hanging out and chatting, and this other teacher comes up to me and says, like, how did you get them to do that? To do what? Oh, they're just so calm and they're respectful. And they're, and we're like, what? Not like that in your class? And they're like, hell no, they're not like that in our class. Pardon me. And so I didn't even, well, Corey and I both, we didn't really realize the impact. Like, that's an impact. Like, they're just kind of calm and relaxed. They're in their element and they're helping serve food and they're doing all these things when they're, you know, little shits in this other class. And yeah. the teacher can't, well, I mean, it's the subject matter too. They're passionate about it and that type of thing. But it's really interesting because you can go through a whole day or a whole school year and not seeing the potential impact that you're having on these kids. And once we realized that, that was kind of like the start for the show, is hopefully we can inspire people to get out there and build something cool, because we've kind of seen, and it's not on our own, like this isn't like us fluffing our egos or anything, but we've kind of seen the impact in our short careers of like 5-6 years. There's been some impacts in kids that have pursued these trades as a career or whatever it is, picked up a new skill, and just from being exposed to it. Have you experienced a lot of that?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, so for me, I ended up primarily teaching adults in my career. But yeah, it's been great when a lot of times years later, somebody will come back and maybe I haven't seen them in all that time. And then they'll start talking about or show pictures on the phone of, I did this and this and this as a result of the cabinet making class I took from you in 1986.
Oh, that's cool.
Wow. That's what a cool growth that they took on as a result of something they saw or heard or read from me a bunch of years ago. So yeah, it's neat. When I'm teaching, when I have people in my shop, the coolest moment is, you know, there's a lot of hand holding the first little bit of a class, and we're going to do this. And then it gets to where they know what we're going to do, and everybody is freewheeling on their own and taking charge of their own projects and moving forward. And that is, to stand back and watch that is so rewarding, that it got to where they're comfortable enough with the tools, the shop, what they're doing, that they're on their own. And the bigger picture of that is presumably, and then people coming back as the example of that, they get in their own shop at home, and then it exponentially increases from there. So that's on a little microscopic level, I'm watching that interaction and that growth happen while they're in the class. But then, yeah, when they come back later, you can imagine in their shop that they keep taking it forward and keep going with it, which is crazy cool.
Kind of like a foundation. You're giving them kind of a baseline, and then you're exponentially there, you know, whether they do it as a hobby or as a career. Like, that's the nice thing. I think lots of people get confused with social media. Sometimes there's always like the end product, and it's more of the process working its way into there. And you're giving them through your classes kind of a baseline and a certain set of skill sets, and then they can take those and jump with them, and yeah, they can do different things, not only just with woodworking, but you're teaching them how to operate in a shop, and, you know, the noises and sounds and blades, and like, it's kind of a dangerous environment when you, you know, when you first get, whether it's a student in high school or an adult who's never done anything, there's a lot of safety that can, or hazards that can come into play. So just being comfortable operating equipment and kind of building that skill set.
Yeah. And I think when I was doing my teacher training, well, and clearly, I mean, that was a bunch of years ago. That was 40 years ago. And I still remember this today. I one of the teaching instructors, not one of the shop teachers, but the guy who was teaching us how to teach, said, it's really important to teach stuff conceptually, not like hair splitting to the whatever the medium is you're working with. So his example of this was, if you can cut up plywood and build a cabinet, you can, with a little bit of change, cut up fabric and make a shirt, and you can cut up sheet metal and make ductwork. And so this idea of looking at stuff conceptually, was that really resonated with me. And maybe because I do a lot of different stuff, like I'm primarily into woodworking, but I am working on cars, and I've got the forge and the anvil. And I'm so like, so, and when DeResta was here, he said a similar thing, that it's like, that it, whether it's metalwork or plastic work or plastic or woodwork, the idea is the same. And it's a little funky with metal, because like welding is additive, you're building up, you're not reducing like you are in woodworking, but the idea for the most part is the same thing. And I've sewed my own clothes, which I'm about, am I going to lose a corner off my man card for admitting this here, but
no,
I had a Singer in college. I had a Singer treadle sewing machine, and I couldn't afford camo gear, so that I wanted to go bow hunt. And yeah, so I got fabric and a pattern, and I stitched gear on my Singer treadle sewing machine. But
you get a corner on your man card for that.
Okay. And I think it's because of that idea. Now, you know, don't look at this as this is the sheet of plywood you're cutting today. Try to look at the 500,000 foot view of what you're doing. And then where does this roll into the rest of my life, mm-hmm, and see what happens.
And I think that's kind of where we get into this thought of like maker, right? And the maker spaces and the maker movement. And you were a maker since before maker was cool. And so I'd like to hear your thoughts on this whole maker movement, and how, is it just like a fancy word for what people have been doing the whole time, or has it encouraged growth in certain areas? What are your thoughts on the whole thing?
Yeah, no, I came out of the magazine industry. I wrote for American Woodworker for a long time, and Family Handyman, and I've done some stuff, you know, kind of all the usual suspects I've done some writing for. And one of the things people often gnash their teeth over in that industry is, we're going to get to a point where we run out of woodworkers, because they're looking for me as a customer. I'm 61, and they see that as this, our demographic is that person. And I always said, well, it's not that the upcoming people may not buy magazines because they're more interested in digital than print, but those people are still out there. You just got to find a way to reach them. And I think today's growth in that arena, the maker arena, is an example of that, where unfortunately for me, because I couldn't land a tech ed job when I got out of school, tech ed programs waned. But the pendulum has swung back to where people have come to recognize, and it's the same with people I get in classes here, they've come to recognize that they can sit in front of a computer and they can do sales or tech or whatever their day job is, but they want to have that opportunity to do something that is more tangible, that they can see the results, they can be tactile with. And that's where woodworking, welding, plastics, knitting, sewing, whatever it is, that people who are more like your guys' age than my age have seen that they want to have that in their lives. And that's where that's coming from. So you look at whatever the Delta ads from 1950 of the guy in still his white shirt and tie running the radial arm saw in his shop after work, you know, so people were always doing this stuff in their houses, but I think it did drop off. And then I think today, like at Maker Camp, that Catskill Mountain Maker Camp is a great example. I'm like the oldest guy there, and everybody else is 40 or 30. And that's so crazy cool that it's this huge group of younger people that are interested enough in this to travel there, to buy tickets to the event, to pay for the lodging, to, they're very, very wrapped up in it. And so, yeah, I think part of that is just, like I said, the pendulum swinging back and people recognizing they need something, they want something to do that's more than playing on a phone or whatever. Yeah. So it's, I think it's a legitimate growth area that's very cool and I'm happy about.
That hands-on tangible, I think that's the, I don't know, with the younger generation, maybe being that 30, 20, 30, but it seems like I agree with your, that pendulum swing. It seems like the trades and the craftsmanship, there's a lot of people that want to get back into that, whether it's knife building, forging. We've been looking at that Catskill camp. We have had Justin Dietrich on before, and he was a big fan of the Catskill Maker Camp, and he heavily suggested us we should check that out. And we've been kind of looking at how we could get down there, and we were close to going,
but then I've discovered my wife's pregnant and due at the end of August, so that I'd come back to a divorce paper on my.
But it seems like up in Canada here, we don't have a lot of those big maker camps where they bring in a wide variety of different craftsmen. So it's interesting to see in down in the States and with some of your classes that you do, it seems like there's a lot of opportunity to bring in kind of a diverse field of makers. And how do you enjoy working with, you just mentioned you have a forge and anvil now. Do you enjoy being around a variety of different craftsmen, people that, you know, do a bunch of different type of work that maybe you don't necessarily do?
Yeah, I think so. Part of it, I think, is my personality is very squirrel, you know, like,
hey, me too.
I'm easily distracted, which can make it difficult when I have a deadline. But the fun part of that, Craig from the Barefoot Forge was hugely influential in like 3 years ago in getting me to the point where I bought the forge and the anvil today, because I had done that kind of stuff in high school and college and then fallen away from it. And then we did it at Maker Camp, and he started me on putting together a Damascus knife blank. I love seeing what other people are doing. And then a lot of times it ends up being, I want to try that too. And then I buy a forge. So same with welding. Like, I mean, I was on a hobby farm for a while, so I had a stick welder, and I could kind of weld to a point where I could put implements back together if I needed to. But I wasn't good at it, but it was something I wanted to grow in. So I bought a better welder, and then I intentionally started just making, you know, to satisfy needs for some of the stuff I needed here in my shop. I started welding that stuff myself instead of buying it. I'm just intrigued by all those different processes. So yeah, it's, see, the epoxy arena is another one that was, the CNC arena is another one that it's just like, you see it for the first time and get a gee whiz effect. And I'm as intimidated as anybody else about my first epoxy pour and my first run on the CNC, determine I'm going to break the machine or whatever. And, but you learn it and off you go and start doing your own stuff.
And now you're doing some of your classes are around CNC epoxy work, live edge slab. Like, that's got to be cool from when you started to doing the magazines, doing classes, and how that the evolution of new products and kind of the in, I don't know, but like epoxy, like you're saying, I love doing that. And it seems like you can do everything, and it really gets the students involved when they can do whether a logo or something cool, river, embed something, pine cones or flowers. Like, it just seems like you can really personalize something, and that must be cool for you to kind of be learning all this stuff and then be able to teach it as well.
Yeah, and it's like I don't know where I just I was teaching at the Mark Adams School, and one of the things they had us do was show slides and of our work and then kind of talk about our history. So the first instructor went and had this very focused type of furniture that they had all these slides of. And the second instructor went and same that I can't remember, like one was furniture, one might've been bowl turning, and here's all these bowls. And then I had my slides ready, and it's like, there's a bowl and there's a table and there's a cedar strip canoe. And there's a, and I said, like, well, unlike these guys, I don't have an area of specialization. I kind of suck a little bit at everything, but I can put my hand to a lot of different stuff. And so, yeah, I epoxy is an example of that. Is Jess Crow was here doing video. I got excited about what she did and taught me. And then I started doing more of it. And then when I could, you know, see one, do one, teach one kind of approach, I learn enough to where I'm comfortable to get that in front of people. And the epoxy stuff is a really, I really like that because it's so creative. It's not lineal at all. I mean, I basically never know what it's going to look like when it's done. And because I'm not good at predicting the epoxy results. Like, you know, when you're talking about putting colors together on the surface of a charcuterie board or something like that. But I like that because when you build a cabinet, it's very predictable. It has to be this big. This table has to be this big. But the epoxy stuff, bowl turning, is very just, it's very organic. And it is fun to watch students do that too, where you give them the tools. And we typically do a test pour on scrap. And then you give them the real piece and turn them loose. And it's neat to see them play with color and put it together and how it comes out.
And you can even incorporate that epoxy into bowl turning. And like it seems like it can just be an additive into everything. I've seen cabinet doors with Livit. Like there's a bunch of companies that do a ton of stuff. And it's not just charcuterie boards or, you know, the river, live edge river tables. It can be added onto. You can start dipping or pouring the ocean onto charcuterie boards and bowl turning, and there's so many different things that where you start to see that kind of artistic side come out where you might not recognize. In our case, and some of the students, like, well, I want to try this. Well, I don't know how it's going to turn out, and then boom, they're hooked on it, and they're doing this stuff that I can't even figure out. And it's just that personalization and that artistic style that I think is kind of shifting a little bit too, where you can be a bit more creative, and it's not like a cabinet, like you were saying, where it's square, it's this tall, it's this wide, and you're allowed to kind of play around and have some fun.
And I think like with the live edge stuff, it's cool because I think for years in woodworking, we were cutting around defects all the time. And I never really was like, I'm a huge fan of having a knot in a bowl or a table or whatever it is, that it's part of the tree. So it is what it is. So today, again, another pendulum swing of I'm going to use this big slab and it's got bark on it and it's got live edges and it's got a crack or a knot or whatever it has. And that's part of the beauty of it, is it's weird looking, but it's cool weird. Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing because it makes everything more unique, where it's like in this part of the country, 99% of houses are just trimmed with red oak trim, you know. It's just like, if I see another piece of baby poop brown red oak trim, I'm going to kill myself. It's just, it's so ubiquitous. So it's neat to see the departure from that. Hickory cabinets were a great growth in that direction. You kind of can't get a piece of hickory that doesn't have a knot in it, or aspen is another example, or not aspen. It's going to come to me when we're done, probably. But anyway, alder, yes. Woods like alder and hickory that are so prone to having knots and stuff in them, and people are okay with that. And there's a kitchen full of alder cabinet doors that are all knotty, and that's cool.
I exclusively use knotty alder in the shop just because it's a great price point and it's got cracks, knots, voids. And to me growing up, everybody used to cut around, and working in a cabinet shop, lots of times the customer wanted clean, you know, premium alder or maple, no knots. And you'd have to be cutting this stuff out and wasting a lot of this material, where it just adds kind of character. And like you said, it's part of the tree. It's natural. And I think when it's a customer saying what they want, that's one thing, but when you're able to kind of build your own thing and incorporate those voids and cracks and knots, when you look at a table that, you know, has that stuff, it looks really cool and adds character to everything.
Yeah. I'm going to redo the cabinets in this office. There's a sink right over there. And I'm going to do those cabinets in alder, and I can't wait because I love the wood. And the stuff that's in here now are like the crappiest home center cabinets ever. So I'm stupid excited about that project. And I have a little dorm fridge I'm looking at on top of the cabinet now, and I'm going to cut the cabinet smaller so I can fit a full-size refrigerator in here, which will hold more gin. Oh, no, I mean,
it's your office. Water. It's okay.
Gin's fine. So, gin's awesome.
There will be lots of evolutions in that fix that are going to be really, really cool for the shop.
That's cool. So when you're talking about creativity, and you said, you know, you can kind of, with those certain projects, there are certain, there's freedom for them, for your students or whoever it is, to get creative. Have you come up against people who are not sure? I know I'm just speaking from my experience with students. When I, let's say with a welding project, I have a couple things that I want them to do to lay a foundation, but then their main project, I just say go. And some of them have trouble with that because some of them really want to be, and I know we're working with younger ages, but I'm just wondering if it continues on into adulthood, with what you've experienced. Some of them just want to be given the directions. What do I do? And just no parameters because there's comfort in that, right? There's discomfort in freedom a lot of times for these students and creativity. Have you come up against that a lot? And how do you encourage these people to just like step out and be creative and take chances? Because there's that imposter syndrome too, that they could probably, I don't know this. I don't know. Well, I don't either, you know? So how do you approach that?
Yeah, it happens where, you're right that people, some people just want to be told what to do. And then when we, I don't know, I guess I just quit answering questions. Like what, you know, a question that's going to start with, well, should I? And sure. Maybe, I don't know if you want to, like, there's no right or wrong answer to this. And, I think for me, it just gets to where once they realize I'm not going to participate in the discussion, then they got to pick that direction and go. And I recognize it's hard, you know, here in my classes, they're paying the tuition. They're maybe traveling from other parts in the country. So they're in a hotel, they're eating their meals in a restaurant. So this is an expensive get-go that they're investing in. And I want them to leave. Another great admonishment from one of my education teachers was never let your students leave with crap. And his reason for that was because their parents' taxes pay your salary. If you're going to be in the public school system, that was the drive behind that. But I also take that to heart that when these people go home, they want to show their spouse, their kids, their whomever, this stuff that they just spent time making. So free will, yes. But don't, you know, I'm maybe watching from afar to prevent them from making some horrible, irreversible mistake that just isn't going to work. I don't know, that I think is a totally bad decision. But yeah, I think a lot of it is to just, I don't know, I was going to say sort of empower, but I guess it is just flat out empower them to feel like it's going to be okay. And some stuff, you know, if we're doing the cabinet and the cabinet making class, there are more materials. And if we mess that up, we can have another go. Back when I was doing guitar making classes, that's not the case. Like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can't freewheel quite as much because you're not going to run to the home center and get another mahogany neck. So that's not as forgiving. But yeah, it's just, I think, just cut them loose as much as you can. And while watching, yeah, to make sure that nothing really bad happens.
Do you find working with adults, it seems, again, coming from a younger generation, teaching the younger, you know, 14 to 18 year olds, the notion around mistakes, do you find sometimes the adults are afraid to try something because they're afraid that they're going to make a mistake, or are they kind of able to work through that and just try it out? And if they make a mistake, then they kind of go from, you know, fix it or problem solve from there?
What a great question. So I got to think a second. I would say, yeah, there's a little tentativeness sometimes because they don't want to screw something up. But part of that, I've been teaching classes like what I do today for a really long time, for 40 years. So at this point, I think part of what helps you know, maybe it's hard for me to answer that question because it doesn't happen too much because I've seen so much stuff go wrong in classes that I'm cutting it off at the pass 3 steps before that bad thing happens. So hopefully I'm giving them the groundwork early, where by the time they get to the joint or the table saw, the bandsaw, I've preempted the potential mistake by saying, so this could happen, but here's what you do. So they have the confidence going into it. But yeah, I think I find that with men in my classes, they pretty much are just going to bull forward and go kind of no matter what. Women in my classes are way more prone to asking questions. And it's not a knowledge-based thing. Like they both have the same high level or low level skill set. But women are way more willing to ask a question when they don't know what they're doing, where a guy is just going to bull forward and pretend like he does know what he's doing. So part of that helps the women end up having, I think, a better experience and a better result, is because before they potentially make a mistake, they're confirming, is this what I should do? And again, I don't want that to sound like a male female knowledge set thing. Mm-hmm. It's a personality thing of willingness to expose yourself a little bit and say, I don't understand this next step. What am I supposed to do? And again, in my experience with people in my hands-on classes, that's women are way more prone to stopping at that point and asking before they move on. So I don't know. I wound off your question.
No, a little bit. It's almost like they have a suspicion of, and I see that in my classes too. They're more more attention to detail and just checking like, hey, this doesn't seem right. Am I doing this okay?
Yeah.
Where the boys in the class, like you said, they just bowl forward and, oh, well, I guess this is built wrong, but I'm just going to be okay with it because I didn't worry about reading the plans or asking questions. And it's kind of a fine line, right? I mean, it's hard to, you want to have some of them you want to let build, and sometimes you have to fix it at the very end, but it's nice to try and catch some of that stuff throughout the process. And it's also, if they do make a mistake, it's also a learning opportunity where I think that pendulum on that is also moving a bit too, where there's a lot to learn from mistakes. I mean, everybody makes mistakes. But what can you take from it and learn to prevent them and or limit those moving forward?
Yeah. And I'm trying to watch, like in the classes I do, I'm trying to watch to where nothing unsafe is going to happen and nothing that's so irreversible that now we have whatever, a cabinet that's kind of going to go on a burn pile instead of in a house. Mm-hmm. But that being said, if it's going in a direction of a little mistake, like, well, okay, no, I see that coming, but I'm going to let it ride because like you said, there's going to be a learning experience that comes from that. Or I'm catching them, like, you know, I'm letting them, I can see them thinking, and then I'm catching them like right before they do that thing and saying, so let's talk about this for a second. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what you were about to do for a second. And so it's, again, use that as a teaching tool for it. So it is, you're right. Making mistakes is a hugely valuable learning opportunity that results in stuff going in the scrap bin sometimes that then hopefully get used for other things. But
I got a question about your experiences. So you mentioned how, and it's really inspiring to me because I struggled with this a lot. I have a bunch of different life experiences. I worked in the automotive industry for a while. I worked with youth in like a youth group kind of capacity, youth pastor kind of capacity. And I've worked in like a hot rod shop and I've worked in, you know, in business and in media and all these things. And I've picked up some skills, just kind of like that jack of all trades, master of none situation. And when Corey and I were first talking, we were hanging out and stuff, and I was like, well, I don't have, because Corey has his red seal. He's a journeyman cabinet maker up here in Canada. And I don't have my welding ticket yet, but I'm going for it now. But I do have these different experiences. And I was kind of getting down on myself.
You were.
For that, because I was kind of imposter syndrome, kind of comparing myself to others, that type of thing. But my question is, because you shared how, okay, well, I dab a little bit in CNC and I dab a little bit here with forging and I dab a little, and you don't, maybe it's just my ego, but it seems like you're humble enough to be okay with not being the, you know, expert on every single one of these. And you, it doesn't seem like you battle with that imposter syndrome, like, oh, I'm going to get found out if I'm not, you know, I'm teaching this stuff or I'm sharing this stuff, but I'm not an expert. How do you get through that mentally?
Well, at some point, and I can't, I was, as you're asking the question, I was trying to get a time frame on when I started saying this, but I don't know when that was. But I started saying it in the woodworking world, honestly, I don't think I'm a great woodworker, but I think I'm a good teacher. So I think, like, in the world of woodworking, welding, and I'll throw another example into this in a second, kind of my superpower is an ability to break skills down and make them teachable. So I coached high school volleyball for a while, and it's not that I'm a great volleyball player, but I did that at the high school and junior Olympic level for like 5 years.
Oh,
so,
wow, cool.
So I think that for me, I'm okay with it because it's just how my personality is I like doing a lot of different stuff. And with Woodworkers Guild of America, it's Woodworkers Guild. So like the company that owns that is not interested. Like if it were me, I don't know, maybe my YouTube channel might look like DeResta's, where it's doing cars and rehabbing a bandsaw and then doing some woodworking and then some leather work. Cause in my real life, that's what I'm doing. I just bought a heavy duty sewing machine so I could stitch leather, because I made my own quiver a couple of years ago and I hand saddle stitched the whole 122 stitches.
And it sucked.
So I bought a leather sewing machine. So I think it's okay in my head. And the other example I was going to throw in is I've been at a boxing gym for 2 or 3 years now, and this is my first time doing it, but subsequently now I'm helping train the new boxers that are coming in. And it's not because I'm a great boxer, but it's because I can observe and I can break skills down to a more manageable level, to look at this stuff like microscopically and say, so it's just that your feet are a little too close together. I think that idea just applies to like everything I do from the teaching perspective. But yeah, I think it's just who I am is that I like doing a lot of different stuff. I'm probably never going to build the Cremona serpentine drawer front Chippendale or whatever style furniture that is. I don't even know. It's just not my bag, or the really fine holly inlay stripes that are going into whatever that type of furniture is. You know, it's just not my, that's not my thing. But I can build a pretty fast and cool mission style piece, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, and that's okay.
And I'm going to weld legs for it. So,
well, you're kind of drawn off your passion and your interest, right? Lots of times when you're doing stuff that you're not really necessarily into or interested in, you don't really give it your all. Where if you're doing stuff that you're comfortable and you're enjoying, it sounds like whether it's forging, leatherwork, sewing, like, I don't know, it's something to be said about. It's almost kind of like a lifelong learning, and you're always up for trying new things and trying to better yourself. And I think being able to have a big bag of skill sets spread across, you know, horizontally, and having a big set of skill sets is good to have. And then, like you said, being able to break skill sets down into more teachable aspects. I sometimes struggle with that in my classes, but even with that, I'm like, okay, like, let's break this down into some smaller pieces. When a student has a question on, hey, can I try this out? And I have no idea. I kind of freeze a bit and go to YouTube and start watching videos, but then just trying to having that mindset of breaking it down into more manageable chunks of material that somebody's going to hopefully understand.
Yeah.
Is beneficial.
Yeah. I don't know. And it's fun. Like, I'm glad I love my shop and I like woodworking. But I also really like having all this other, I cut leather. So in the world of mixing mediums, I cut leather on my CNC machine for the first time the other day.
No way.
Making a little pouch for a block plane. So yeah, drag knife on the CNC so I could draw it in V-carve and cut it on the CNC. And that was crazy cool.
That is cool.
It's just another, like, you know, I'm pretty confident the Donick drag knife can do this. Conceptually, I think this is going to work. So then I messed, you know, I got leather on Amazon and stuck it to the machine and off it went, and it worked. So yeah, just so a lot of weird little stuff like that.
How do you stick how did you stick the leather to the,
you can either use spray adhesive, and if you do that, smooth side down, because then it's relatively easy to clean off the smooth side. So the first time I did it, I used tack adhesive, and it wasn't bad cleaning it up. The second time I tried it, I used masking tape to hold it down. So the piece was, the blank was 12 by 18, and I just masking taped the edges of it, like, very firmly. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of lateral cutting pressure from that drag knife, so that held fine. You just have to be a little, you have to experiment a little bit, because there's a little bit of pressure from the drag knife. So whatever it is you're cutting, so it could be leather or plastic or inlay material, wood inlay. Mm-hmm. You don't want it to, like, stretch or shift a little bit as you're cutting, or you're going to lose detail. So the spray adhesive on a flat spoil board is 100%. It will not move. And as long as you can have the opportunity to clean that off of the final product, it'll be fine.
Now, do you take that draw knife right down to the spoil board? Like, exactly.
You zero it. You can't zero it with a touch plate. You zero it with the paper method, you know, okay. Pulling the paper under the cutter.
Yeah.
And then, it's cutting them. So your depth of cut that you put into the tool path is the thickness of your material. And it's kissing right. You can't really see a mark on the spoil board when you're done. Mm-hmm. So it's just kissing that surface just barely. But yeah, you need to, like, my machines all have slats and then T-track in between. So it's not a continuous surface. For this, you really want a continuous surface. So I have a fake spoil board I put on top of my spoil board. Mm-hmm. And then you need to fly cut that, because you're in bazillionths of an inch for this to work or not. You know, to cut all the way through, you're in really tiny parts of an inch.
Yeah.
That leather was 63/1000ths of an inch thick. So you got to fly cut that fake spoil board to make sure it's dead flat, and then you're ready to go.
That's so cool. I just got a 4x4 CNC this year in the school, and a leather would be a cool.
That's so cool.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like and probably for you getting into CNC, I feel like it's such a, you've got the, not only how to run your machine, then you've got the software with running V-Carve Pro Vectric, which is amazing. And I can do kind of the basics, but then to get that next step, there's so much different things you can cut. Like polycarbonate and etch things, and there's laser. You have the Axiom CNC, correct?
Well, because of the classes, so I've got an Axiom, 2 ShopBots, a Laguna, and a Next Wave.
Nice,
that's awesome.
I originally wanted to get a
Shaper Origin.
Okay, and those things are. I've got one of those in the shop too. Yeah. Those Axioms are nice because you can get the rotary lathe or else the laser too, which I was kind of bummed I couldn't get. But there's so many. Even that one machine, now you can bring in a whole different ton of different mediums, right?
Yeah, when I did, so I do CNC typically at Maker Camp at the Catskill thing. And when I went last year, and it's ShopBot that I do that, I'm on their machine, it's ShopBot sends me to that. So I said to them, I think, especially with the younger crowd that comes to this, we need to do weird CNC stuff. So, I engraved plexiglass, I cut aluminum, cut and engraved aluminum. I think I took a drag knife, but it was like, I don't know if I even took a router bit. Like I was very intentionally looking to do weird stuff on the machine. You can put felt tips in into the spindle, and you can use the machine as a plotter. And where in your tool path, you would change tools to get a different profile from the cut, you change colors. So okay. I've taken artwork that my middle kid has drawn 5x7, scanned it, blown it up to 16x24, and plotted that on the CNC and turned her sketches into huge artwork pieces that I can draw out with a felt tip on the CNC.
That's wow. That's amazing. It's this whole thinking outside the box, hey?
Like, yeah.
That's amazing. I know we have, I just got a 4x4 plasma CNC, like a plasma table at our school. We fundraised for it. And giving the, even something as simple as Tinkercad, letting the kids just go with that and using their imagination and doing that. And then they can, I had a kid do like a tree of life thing or also create parts that they can then weld together. And they're like, oh, do you think we can make this? And it's things I've never even thought about before. It's like, okay, yeah, go do it. Let's have fun, you know? And it's really refreshing to know, George, that you're constantly just like thinking, hey, maybe I could cut leather on this thing. Like, that's so cool. I love it.
Yeah. It's just, well, yeah. I mean, it has its downsides because like I sometimes lack focus, like pretty much all the time lack focus, but the deadlines typically get met generally most of the time sometimes. And so it all kind of, I work a lot of hours a week and that makes it all balance out.
Yeah.
There you go. So wrapping up here, we kind of usually end the shows with a couple standard questions here. What is some advice you have for somebody who wants to get started into the area of woodworking?
I would, so the online stuff is great. And clearly I've got 80 billion online streaming instructional videos out there. However, look for a place where you can go take a class. A lot of schools, Mark Adams, I mentioned that I'm at, my school here, Rockler stores, Woodcraft stores, are good at offering classes. So one, look for a place where you can take a hands-on class, because that's really going to shortcut people learning bad habits and getting started on a better foot. Additionally, look for a club or a guild in your area, because there's going to be a big knowledge base there that, again, will short circuit you slogging, where can I buy better quality hardwood or whatever. 80 people in that group already know where you can get better quality hardwood. So I think that's a big deal. And the hands-on classes and looking for a club. And then you got to practice. And I jump on people on this in my classes all the time. Like, you wouldn't just get a guitar and then say, okay, I'm going to go play a gig. Because you got to learn to play the guitar, and then you got to practice, and then you're going to go play a gig. So, but with woodworking, we feel like I bought a dovetail jig, so now I'm cutting dovetails for this huge cabinet I'm making for my spouse for Christmas or whatever. Well, you got to like just throw some secondary material in there first, cut a bunch of joints that may or may not work, get comfortable with it. So same, like sometimes you just got to go in your shop and putz and get the hang of doing whatever it is, running the table saw or cutting a specific joint. And then you hang that piece on the wall as an example of what you did wrong or did right. And you use it as a learning tool for next time. But take the time, you know, find something you want to make, because that will drive you to learn the skills to make it, but practice those skills before you're making the thing.
Yeah. I like it. Now on with that advice, what about some specific skill sets that are important to develop getting into the woodworking?
Well, so I would say a good skill would be using SketchUp. I don't know. Does that count? Like,
for sure.
I'm guilty for years, like for decades of my woodworking life. I would picture a thing in my head. Then I would build it in my head. So at idle moments, I'm thinking about, okay, I'm going to cut the dados, and then I'm going to, and then I'd go in the shop and I'd make it. And mostly it would come out okay, but not always. So for me, learning SketchUp was huge. I remember the first thing I did on there was a dresser I then did on video, and I wanted the drawers to be graduated. So figuring out that graduation, like, the old George would have just gone in the shop and cut a bunch of drawers and figured that's probably going to work. SketchUp George draws all that in SketchUp, and then you can fluidly change it as many times as you want because you're not burning up material on the drawing. So I think investing in learning to get something on paper before you're going to cut wood. Everybody's talking about the prices of material today. So this is probably even more important than it was in the past, that you don't want to waste any material. So I think that's good. Somehow learning how to get your thoughts on paper before you cut wood is going to force you to think through the process. Safety is huge. You got to develop, that's not just a skill, it's an attitude about, I'm way better at following my intuition today than I used to be. And that's part of it, is like, I legitimately work a lot of hours, but knowing when to be done, like in the tooling side of my shop, as opposed to, okay, I'm getting stupid and tired, but I can still come in here and edit a video. Like I can pull that off, but I'm not going to run tools. So that the safety attitude, the safety aspect, to make sure you're going to be safe working in your shop. And then, I don't know, can you develop the skill set of like 3D picturing? I don't know. Like,
oh yeah, I think so.
If there's a way to do that, I would say work on that, because that's, that ability to see, to get how something's going to look in three dimensions before you start working on it is huge.
Does SketchUp have that ability to do 3D?
Yep. And SketchUp will give you that, but still, I think just when you're, you know, there's a methodology to stuff. And I think, well, I guess some of that can come from classes. Like, and this is a thing I see with students, like, well, and with my kids. So my son worked for me and he's very lineal. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. My middle kid, who was the artistic one, she worked for me and she's like 1, 7, 4, 3, 9, 8. And we're probably still going to get to 10, but her path is way different. So trying to get a handle on that methodology of what makes sense in wood, in a woodworking project to do first, which isn't always given. Like you get if you get an article, a plan in a magazine, it might not have a sequence of events. It might only have a plan. So developing that logical sequence in your head of, it makes the most sense, and cabinet making, it's easy for me. I'm going to make the carcass first, then we're going to do the face frame, then we're going to do the door, then we're going to do the drawer, because one leads to the next, leads to the next, leads to the next. But a rocking horse has the same challenges of what's the sequence of events for that project. So developing that part of your brain, I think, is important to avoid mistakes and get where you want to go.
And understanding that process can be tricky if you don't, like with students that you teach and that we teach, they don't understand the whole process of how to go through and build a cabinet. So that gets a bit tricky too, trying to navigate if you don't have those kind of foundational or baseline knowledge of how something goes together. Then you really have to get creative on how to, you know, how is this going to go together before I start making miscuts and going through lumber that costs a fortune now, right?
Yeah.
So last question, top three starting out tools that you would recommend for somebody getting into this trade.
A credit card with a really high limit. Yeah. That's the first one.
That's perfect. That's a good one.
Yeah.
It's hard. So for a really long time, I said, no one will argue with saying a table saw. However, today, you could argue that a track saw can do so much of what a table saw can do. So maybe to cast a wider net onto that as a category, something with which you can lineally, straightly cut stuff. So in a space constraint, a track saw can work for that. That Craig, shoot, what's it called? That system that Craig sells now. Like Festool's table. I can't remember what it's called, but that's a pretty cool system. But you need a way, besides a circ saw and a jigsaw, to repeatedly, consistently, accurately cut stuff to size. So table saw. And then, you know, tools number 1 through 10 change so much depending on what you're going to do. I love a bandsaw, and my kids used a bandsaw learning woodworking long before they used a table saw for ripping, because it's so much safer than a table saw. I would advocate a bandsaw. And then if you're forcing me to pick a third one, probably a router table. Hugely versatile tool. You can, of course, take the router out of it and use it handheld. So you kind of get a two for one out of a router table. You can joint on a router table. So if you don't have a jointer yet, you can do that work on your router table. And then there's all the decorative edge stuff and joinery stuff you can do on a router table. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it until I change my mind.
That was four because you had the credit card too. Oh, yeah, that's the best one. Yeah, I like that answer. I want the credit card first so that I can go start buying stuff.
Yeah. Well, George, thank you. This has been amazing. It's been an hour and it's gone by fast, and I could just sit and listen to your wisdom all day. I really
well. Thanks for using the word wisdom. Yeah. There were so many words you could have put in there. Thank you for using wisdom.
I learned at a young age to listen to my peers and to listen to the value that they have to share, and you have a ton of it, and I'm sure that Bill and George would be super proud of you, of where you're at right now.
Thanks.
And we really appreciate your time, and as we sign off here, where can people find you, and is there anything you'd like to promote that you have going on right now?
Well, so my website is VonDriscaWoodworks.com, and then Instagram is my most active social media place. So VonDriscaWorks, that's Instagram and Facebook, but again, Instagram is the most active of that. In the world of doing stuff besides woodworking, maybe a year ago I started an Instagram page. It's my name, George VonDriska 3, because I'm George VonDriska the 3rd. And that one is motorcycle, camping, photography, like all the other boxing, archery, all the other weird stuff I do. So that's my other Instagram page. And I'm trying with that to not just here I am camping, but it's camping with this backpacking stove, this is what's good and bad. So just like I'm teaching on the woodworking page, I'm trying to teach or provide buying advice on that other page. And then Woodworkers Guild of America, of course, is where WWGOA.com is where all my videos show up. And then my big thing, I'm uber proud of the Live Edge Slab book that published last November. I did all the photography for that myself. It was number one in three different categories on Amazon for a bunch of months. It's been selling really, really well. So I wish if I could remember the exact title, I would say it. But hang on, it's right here. how crazy is that? Woodworker's Guide to Live Edge Slabs. Oh, we're not video. I'm showing it to the computer.
Yeah.
Woodworker's Guide to Live Edge Slabs, available on Amazon and a lot of other booksellers. The book was a crazy intensive project, but I'm very, very happy with how it came out and how it's gone with the publisher there.
That's cool. Well, we will we'll link to all that in the show notes of this episode. And for all of our other episodes and show notes and social media links, it'll be all linked in the show notes of this episode too. So George, once again, thank you so much for your time today. It was awesome. And we'll definitely need to have you on again because you're such a wealth of knowledge. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks to you guys for having me. I appreciate being asked. It was very fun. And you're right, it went by, the hour went by crazy fast.
It went by super fast. And thanks for everyone for listening. Thank you, Hoff.
Thanks, Rosie.
And we'll see you guys on the next one.